My name's Andy Oates. I'm actually, on paper, I'm one of the organisers of this. of course, as we all know, I didn't do very much. But that doesn't lessen my enthusiasm for the whole project, of course. In fact, I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. And I was here last in 2013, and I see some faces that are familiar from that time, and a whole bunch of new faces. So I think you've already been going 4 days. I'm sorry about that. I ran into trouble with the U.S. State Department, who gave me a J-1 visa. So that's all I'm going to say, and I'm happy I've got one. But I came to the first available date that I could get here. So my apologies for that. I got here last night. So my next apology is going to be for the lucidity of this talk. What I wanted to do is give you a very basic overview of how I think about zebrafish. Probably most of the subtopics, like any model organism, you could spend time just talking about that, all the details. I wanted to try and be as critical as I could of zebrafish, because after you work with any organism for a while, you realize all of its weaknesses. And that's why I put that in the title. I think there are a lot of good things about zebrafish, but I also think there are a lot of painful things about working with zebrafish. So that's my goal. What I wanted to do was illustrate this with quite a few movies, time-lapse movies, microscopy, because I think that is one of the strengths of zebrafish. It's nearly transparent, and you can, if you set up your microscope, okay, you can take some very nice images from it. Unfortunately, I updated my operating system, and discovered that many of the movies didn't play. And I was in one of those situations where you're calculating the probability that you can solve the problem, the time it's going to take you, and then the remaining time that it's going to be, and then so I decided to go for sort of more classical. Words on a board. There are some movies that work, so that's cool. But I'm sure
it didn't crash. Mine crashed in February.
Ah,
dead.
Did you have it backed up?
I bought a new one.
Even better.
The backup was there, but it's fine.
Okay, yeah. What did you buy, Tom?
I just bought a new computer because during that period. Oh yeah.
Product placement. So, good. So, right, so zebrafish. So, you've had a bunch of model organism talks so far about, what have you had so far? Flies and worms? What else? Anything else?
No worms, flies.
Crustaceans.
Flower beetles, yes.
Flower beetles, Archibolium, excellent. Okay. So this is the first vertebrate?
Yes.
Okay. So this is the zebrafish. To give you some idea, to scale, a human is about... I think that illustrates to you the importance of scale bars. Actually, they're quite small. They're about this long, fully grown. And at most stages we study them, they're 1 or 2 millimetres long or across. My association with zebrafish started when I was doing my PhD in Melbourne, and I had accepted to do a PhD, or maybe the other way around, my supervisor had accepted to do a PhD in me, and I was interested in these new class of molecules called JAK kinases. You've probably heard about them. And Andrew Wilkes was the name of my supervisor, and he had done a degenerate oligo PCR, for those of you who that still means something, and had found a whole bunch of JAKs, and his term for that was just another kinase, because at that time they found so many new kinases. I have to remember, this was only a few years after the first tyrosine kinase had been identified biochemically and shown to be involved in tumorigenesis, so as an oncogene. So these were very, very heady times to find 50 new... Boris, thanks for turning up, mate. No. And so I had previously studied Drosophila as an undergraduate and master student with Robert Saint in Adelaide. And he had these class of new tyrosine kinases, and he was doing a bunch of cell culture experiments. And I said, you are never going to find out what these genes do, proteins do. In your weird cell culture, what you need to do is you need to get these genes from a model organism, find a mutation in them, and then look at what they do in vivo, look at what their function is. And so he said, all right, well, you come and do it, and you show me how that all works. So I thought I'd take a broad strategy. I would try and clone the molecules from, and this is when we did radioactive screens of phage libraries, of worms, flies, and zebrafish, because I thought those would be sort of good systems. And in the end, I went with the discoveries that we had in the zebrafish, and we decided to build a zebrafish facility, and there wasn't any in Australia at that time. And my supervisor said, yeah, I reckon we should just go up to the pet shop up in Northcote and buy a fish facility. I mean, how difficult can it be? We've got one at home, you know. So I said, yeah, I guess, yeah, let's do it. So we jumped in his car, we went up to the pet shop, we bought 5 tanks and a little, you know, pump and a reservoir at the bottom and a, I kid you not, a skeleton with the wheel and, you know, the chest that opens with the bottom. Because we thought that would be funny. It was. And although this is about the funniest it's ever been, now I think about it. Okay, so we got the fish there. We just bought normal zebrafish from a pet store. They cost about 50 cents at that time. And we put them in. And then my road to misery started. Because watching them swim around was very difficult to getting them to breed. And so I knew nothing about aquaria. And so I started to email people in the research community who did work with zebrafish. And this is where I met the people in Oregon, at the University of Oregon. So Chuck Kimmel, Monty Westerfield, Judith Eisen. And they had started studying zebrafish a decade before, in fact, quite a bit before that, about 15 years before, when George Streisinger, who had come from the phage group in Caltech, he said, Ryan, I would really like to understand how the human brain works. I think to understand how the human brain works, you need to know how it grows, how it develops. And so I'm going to apply the methodology of mutagenesis that we have practiced in the phage group, Caltech, to a vertebrate organism. So I need to have an organism, a vertebrate that has a vertebrate brain. I need to be able to see the brain just by looking at it, simply. And I need to be able to mutate this animal and retrieve phenotypes that I can understand. So this probably sounds familiar to some of you. And the legend has it that George just did what I did and walked down to the, I mean, I was copying him, obviously, walked down to the pet store in Oregon and looked at all their fish. And he said, I don't want to study something that's impossible to maintain. So if the local aquarium shop can do it, then I probably can too. And picked out a zebrafish. So Oregon, they were amazing. They emailed me. They said, if you're coming through, come and visit. I visited them. I looked in their fish facilities. They sent me protocols. It was really extraordinary experience scientifically of help and sharing and understanding stuff. So that's my call out to Oregon, who started the scientific research of zebrafish. So I finally got zebrafish to breed, and then I'll stop talking about my PhD. And then I was entranced by the beauty of the embryos, because they are spectacular. And I think anyone who's an embryologist falls in love with their bug or worm or creature or whatever it is, and you learn more and more about them. And then I think that the more you learn, still the more beautiful and mysterious they become, because you realise, you see things that you don't understand, and so this is the motivation, it's a big part of the motivation. Okay, zebrafish. So I've worked in a number of zebrafish labs and facilities since then, in Australia and the US, in Germany, and now in the UK. And the worst one I've ever worked in is the one I'm working in right now. Not because the fish facility per se is perhaps so bad, although it's quite old, but because the infrastructure around it's so bad. In February, a pipe connecting all of the toilets in the anatomy building had been repaired with a piece of cardboard. Now, think about this. Why you would repair It was taped up. When it got wet, it fell back into the pipe and blocked, causing all the stories above to flow through that pipe and out into the wall cavity. Down through the wall cavity, under the floor of the Jay-Z Young Lecture Theatre, where it pooled, and it made the lectures even worse than they normally were. And then it dripped through the slab into my tanks. Okay, so everyone who's cultured animals or worked with animals, of course, has these kind of horror stories of when things go wrong. So that's my current favourite. All right. I'm going to move to a new fish facility soon. In fact, I'm going to leave the country. So I'm starting a new position at EPFL in Lausanne in Switzerland in September. Not because of the poo incident, although that is a factor. But I will be very sad to leave London. It's got lots of amazing things in London, but I'm very happy to be going to EPFL. So if anyone wants to talk to me about that later on, I'm more than happy to. Okay, zebrafish. Right. So I wanted to divide these things to talk about what is a zebrafish, because I think there's quite a lot of misconception about what a zebrafish is, how you house and raise them, some background on the genetics, because it was this sort of background genetics, genomics now, and then talk a little bit about the strengths for embryology, almost in a classic embryological sense, deal with some molecular techniques, and then talk about things where I think the future either needs a lot of work, or there's a real opportunity to do things. And I'm not sure whether I finished the future slides before my brain shut down, so we'll discover that when we get there. Okay, good. So what is a zebrafish? They're vertebrates. They're part of the chordates, which includes sea urchins and tunicates and amphioxus. They've got a backbone, but they also have a jaw, so they are within now the jawless, this part of the tree of vertebrates. They are a bony fish, so they're not a cartilaginous fish like a shark. So we call that an osteichthys, bony fish. So here's bony fish. They are a particular kind of bony fish that they are, is a teleost. So I'm going to go into explore the bony fish a bit more. One massive part that we rank very highly of the bony fish are the tetrapods. They're called Cycopterygians, which means lobe-fin fish. And so all of this part here are the one half of fish, I would claim. They're the lobe-fin fish. The ray-fin fish all stack into this sort of what is here being termed bony fish. So zebrafish, pufferfish, all the other madakas, they all sit in here. So if we dig in a bit further, we'll see that it's an Ostariophysum, and within that it's a cyprinid, which means it's actually very closely related to goldfish. So if you see a goldfish, that's actually quite unrelated actually to madaka or pufferfish. So when we think about things, how different things are, you always go back on this, and you can see that birds and reptiles and mammals they have quite an ancient split. So you're going back well over 350 million years ago. And if you would look at the divergence on the next slide, the divergence between zebrafish and pufferfish, it's a similar distance. But the point I want to make here is, before we get to the fish, is it's often said, zebrafish are a simple vertebrate. But one has to be really careful about saying simplicity. Depends on what you're looking at, what organ system you're looking at. They've had just as many years to evolve specific molecular mechanisms, biological mechanisms, behaviours, as anything else has that's extant. In fact, maybe quite a lot longer than something that's branched very recently. And so I would say that they're quite a complex vertebrate. Okay. All right, so what am I talking about? So this now goes into fish, and you can break the fish into two massive groups, into the Cycopterygii. But once you've got a jaw and a bony skeleton, you've got the lobe fins, and then all of the ray fins are over here. And there's tens of thousands of these species across the watery surface of the Earth. The
the Acanthopterygii have massively radiated, and almost certainly, if you see a picture of a fish, it's going to be one of these guys, the darker pufferfish. Most of the stuff you can eat is in this. But the branching off here are Ostariophysi, and that's where goldfish and carp and zebrafish is. Now, the Ostariophysi have an amazing bone structure just behind their head, and it instead of ribs, it has two bones that grow back posteriorly into the body and touch the swim bladder. And only the Ostariophysi have it, and the Ostariophysi are massively radiated in freshwater ecosystems. So these guys dominate freshwater ecosystems, and it's the hypothesis is that these bones in the neck and couple to the swim bladder and form some kind of ear, some way of sensing vibrations or sound in the water. So that hasn't been proven, but that's a speculation. Okay, good. So that's so then just a warning that the zebrafish are quite distantly related to the other model fish that we've got, and that the divergence time is as far as the difference between chicks and mammals or something like that.
What's in between Actinopterygii and Neopterygii? What kind of animals are these?
Garfish are very primitive and polypterous. There aren't very many species left of these branches. So I think garfish come out here, and in these basal beds of the polypterous is perhaps a really... So they're characterized by having...
Seawater fishes.
So polypterous is fresh. Gar is salt. Okay, please stop me if there's any questions, and also correct me if you think I've made a mistake or screwed something up. So now, when you say zebrafish, this is the last bit of sort of evolution, I think, that I want to talk about. So the name of the species name for zebrafish is Danio rarido, but there are lots of Danios actually. There's over 20 Danio species that are recognised, and they have a range of different patterns. There's a zebrafish up here, but these are all different. Danios in the species group, and it actually Dave Parisi's group showed that some of these species pigment patterns match single gene mutations in the Danio rarido. He's actually identified two of those loci by interspecific hybrids. So these fish will still interbreed. Some of these fish will still interbreed in laboratory situations. Of course, they never meet each other normally, but you can actually do some interspecific genetics by mutating in the zebrafish and then crossing to the different species. I think that in the same way that's been some fantastic evolutionary studies done on neighbouring Drosophilas, that this is still an opportunity that's really waiting to be harvested to look at diversity in the fish, and it's also something that's been, I think it's really been taken up on with the sticklebacks, looking at different species of sticklebacks. Okay.
Why is it called zebrafish?
Yeah, stripes? Yeah, I know, they're the wrong way around. Yeah. I think that the first one that was seen was actually dead and was floating like this in the water. I don't know. I mean, it would have called this a zebrafish, but not that one. Yeah. Yeah, good figure. So, okay, keeping zebrafish. So just a few words then on what it's like to actually maintain a research aquarium to do work with zebrafish. I think one thing that was a belief that goes around is that they're cheap. Or get zebrafish, they're really inexpensive. I don't think that's true. They may be less expensive than keeping mice, but they're certainly a lot more expensive than keeping flies or worms. And part of that has to do with the regulatory things that surround them because they're a vertebrate. So before you fearlessly go into doing zebrafish research, consult your local animal legislation, because depending where you are,
they are ranked as more or less alive or more or less an animal at various stages of their lives. And this really does depend on the country you're in. So in the United Kingdom, until they reach 5 days of development, they don't count as a true vertebrate, as an animal. And so you can sort of do anything you like to them. And then suddenly, day five dawns, and the full weight of Her Majesty's regulatory apparatus comes down on your head. So you really want to make sure you're not screwing around on night 4.5, or you could be in big trouble. Okay, so so I suppose relatively they're relatively inexpensive. Although anyone who keeps them will know the charges that can be levied to grow them. Can be kept at high density, up to 12 fish per litre, if the water's running fast enough to exchange, take away all the waste products. And in a big fish facility, you can have thousands of tanks and tens of thousands of these animals swimming. And it becomes a real work to keep all the fish fed, to keep them bred, to keep them and keep them healthy. So this could be quite an activity. So it takes about between 2 to 4 months until offspring. So this is how you make them. You get a net, it's old school, get a net, scoop out a male, put him in a small breeding tank, get a scoop out a female, and put her in the same small breeding tank, and then the breeding tank needs to be equipped with a grill. I'll tell you why in a sec. Put a lid on them, because when they get excited, they can jump out. And then you put them up on a shelf somewhere, nice and warm, and then you go away. And then you come back the next day, and they are stimulated by lights on to start breeding. So if you don't want them to start breeding straight away, you put a little divider in, so they swim around on the other side of the glass and gaze at their beloved. It does help for them to be in the same water, because they swap pheromones. And that's actually an important part of getting them ready to breed. Pull out the divider, or just let the lights come on. The female swims around. The male chases her, I'm just going to get this right, and chases her and tries to nip her flanks, I think that's the technical term. And then she drops eggs, if she's in the mood, and then he jettisons his milt. That's also the technical term. So it's external fertilisation. The eggs are fertilised in the water column, they drop down. The zebrafish will eat their own eggs, and that's why we put we have to put a grill in the tank. Otherwise they would clean up the tank. So they swim around the top, they drop down eggs, and then we can pick off the adults in the top part, and then quite simply just pour the eggs off the bottom of the tank into a tea strainer, give them a quick squirt with some buffer, some fish water, and then tip them into a pitcher, bang, bang, bang. With the tea strainer, you whack it 3 times hard on the edge of the bench, and that dislodges any of the eggs that were still stuck there, so you don't cross-contaminate the different clutches that you're picking up, and then that's your harvest from a pair. So they're going to, when by the time they grow to sexual maturity, that can be 4 months. It actually depends on their density, how much they're fed, the temperature. But this is a real bottleneck.
How many eggs per pair?
You get. I think the record we've ever seen is about 600 from one female. So that corresponds to her losing about a third of her body weight. How long does it take her to lay that? 10 minutes? 15 minutes? Yeah. It's extraordinary.
So you need to feed them.
You need to?
The female.
Oh, yes. Yeah, sure. That's an important part of feeding females, yes. We do feed females. Actually, I want to come to that, because feeding is actually critically important. I guess. So whether you are making mutants, making transgenes, you need to be able to turn them over to see what has inserted, what's being mutated, and this sort of 4 months time scale till you turn them over, that can really slow you down. And seriously, if you're a PhD student starting a project and the supervisor says, I think you should make a transgene, have a really hard think about it and make it in the first year. In fact, make 3 of them in the first year, but don't wait until the last year of your project and go, you know what, I really need that transgene.
It's not like a bacteria or a fly or something. You can have multiple goes reasonably and have a good chance. So this, I used to think this was quick, but now I'm incredibly frustrated by it. So what we tend to do is we tend to grow two tracks. We put fish at low density in tank, we give them heaps of food, love them, and they grow quickly, they get to sexual maturity fast. But it turns out that their eggs aren't very high quality, and they're not reproductively active for very long. So that appears to be the price you pay for fast turnover. If you want high quality eggs to be able to do quantitative biology on the embryos as they grow up, then you grow them slowly. And then they appear to be reproductively active for a lot longer, and larger females give better quality eggs. That's been demonstrated. So this is sort of the part of what you need to know. Okay. So I was saying before how much I appreciated the guests.
What do you mean by quality is reproducibility?
Yeah. What do I mean by quality? This has been one of the things I've been trying to put my finger on for the last 3 years in the UK. What is the quality of an embryo? And it's tempting to say, well, it's a bit like pornography. You know it when you see it, but you can't define it. I didn't make that up, but that's famous Supreme Court judge. So I think the most important thing is that you define what aspect of embryological growth you're interested in, or you know what it is you're interested in, and then you have to say, to what precision do I need some behaviour to happen? What reproducibility? And you have to ask yourself, how reproducible is that? You have to be careful not to narrow it down too much, because you might be looking at, say, the ear forming, but you don't look late, and by 4 days all of your animals are dead for some other cause. I would be very worried about studying the ear in an animal that died 3 days later or something. So I think some general overview of the first week of development, at least, is necessary to have the context. Say, okay, there's normal development, and so by quality, I mean reproducibility. Yeah, reproducibility. Okay, community. One thing that's very frustrating about zebrafish is how difficult it is to send them anywhere else. And although there's quite a web of Horace is laughing, great. So although there's a very well-established web for example, transporting mice. Okay, so this is, you know how to do it, right? It's still remarkably not worked out how to send zebrafish, and different countries have quite different rules. And for example, we have not been able to send. We have not been able to get any fish from Japan in the UK because the UK body that adjudicates these applications does not recognise the Japanese veterinary service. Sorry, just I don't recognise your veterinary service, so I can't get a letter from a Japanese vet saying whether the fish are healthy or not. I mean, so this is one example. It would help, I think, if. So there's a new international zebrafish society that's being started now by Mary Mullins, amongst others. I think one of the key issues for that body is to try and work out really silly stuff like this. So please, we need a standard protocol to do this. What ends up happening is there's one company that can do it. They're very, very expensive. That can be half your research budget gone by bringing in a new line. This is going to change because we can make new mutants, but still, if you want to work on the same line, you need to send it. Legal aspects. So what actually ends up happening is that people put flasks of larvae in their pocket or in their carry-on bag, and they go backwards and forwards. So I didn't say that. But what happens when the regulatory burden becomes too high is people just do it anyway, and that defeats the whole purpose. So I think we really need to think very carefully about that. Okay, keeping zebrafish, not dangerous. In contrast to working on great white sharks or taipans or funnel-web spiders, which were the other model organisms of choice that I had when I was growing up. The only way you can get hurt by a zebrafish is if you're eating them and you choke. So whatever you do, use a knife and fork. Okay, now this is the last thing I want to say about this. I've got question marks here for standard line and standard husbandry. And again, this is a bit frustrating. So you'll often hear that zebra fish are really hardy. They're easy to keep. They're easy to grow. They actually are pretty hardy, and they are pretty easy to grow. And I think what has happened is that that means that there are many individual husbandry protocols which will work. They work, right? But because of the effect of husbandry, particularly on the mother's egg production, it means that there are very different kinds of zebrafish babies being laid around the world, even with the same genotype. Because, you know, if the baby gets a whole bunch of stuff from its mum, then the way it runs its early development is massively, I'm just saying something that's obvious, right? It's massively influenced by the mother's contribution. So amazingly enough, we don't even have a standard protocol for raising zebrafish. And if you looked in a zebrafish paper, the one thing you will not be able to tell is how they raise their zebrafish. If you look at many other model organisms, for example, in zoology or ecology, when they're doing experiments, the biggest part of their paper is how they cared for their animals, because it makes so much difference. And this, I think, is something we really, as a zebrafish community, again, we've got to really think about this. I think in the past, because they're not fluffy and have little eyes that look up at you, people haven't put a burden, the regulatory burden, and say, right, you guys need to treat these animals properly, you need to invest time and money to work out how to optimally take care of them. They've been sort of pushed to one side, perhaps this is reasonable, I'm not saying, but and so there's a myriad of different protocols around the world producing, I'm going to argue, a myriad of different embryos, actually. What compounds that is that there's no real standard lines in zebrafish, and this is a bit embarrassing, but partly because it's very, very difficult to make an isogenic zebrafish. So it's been done in Oregon by either heat shock or pressure shock to stop meiosis II, and then growing up animals that are actually isogenic. So you can do that, but they have very, very poor viability. They have sex biases. They are awful to work with, just practically. So we actually maintain our functional stocks by continual outcrossing to different strains in the labs. Okay, that'd be fine if we had standard strains, but actually what we've got are isolated breeding colonies of strains that we got from other people, and now these strains are diverging. And so what I might call an AB, which is a classic line from Oregon, is not going to be the same as the line someone else calls AB. So what we've got to do is either sequence these fish every year to work out where they're going, or keep getting in reference fish from, let's say, a frozen sperm sample that's held in a reference unit. But given the trouble of shipping them, I think that's a bit of a problem at the moment. So I think we really have to think very hard about, can we overcome this biologically, or if we can't, how do we record what we're doing so that we know what we've done, actually? So it sounds like I'm pulling the rug out from under my own feet here, because when I go later on, when I talk about the research we're doing, you're all going to go, okay, what's your background strain? What did you feed them? These are actually all very good questions. I can tell you the answers, but I think it's, yeah. Okay, it's not that you shouldn't believe anything you read about zebrafish, it's just that I'm trying to be as honest as I can and say what I think the weaknesses of this system are and where we need to go in the future to make the system.
Is it known that some developmental stages, like the first couple of hours of development versus some mitogenesis or later on, are more or less sensitive to genetic background?
we've been systematically time-lapsing fish from different backgrounds and looking at the dynamics of these different stages. And so we've seen differences between them. We've seen, actually one thing that is amazing is that, for example, the period of somitogenesis, its mean is the same in these different strains, but its variance is quite different, for example. There's big differences in, and this is true also in mice, big differences if you have an allele of a gene, what its phenotype is, can show very strong strain differences. And What the question you're asking, though, is whether I could say that the heart develops differently in this strain versus that strain.
Whether this is the sensitivity to genetic background is strong at some stages.
Oh, I see.
Less at
like some sort of constraint. Yes. Early on, it's quite variable. And so the when we time lapse in the early stages, we see quite a lot of difference in the timing, cell divisions, the movement of a pupillae, for example. That can be quite variable between strains. By the time you've got to about 24 hours, when the animal has sort of completed its basic body plan, then we don't see very much difference. But I have to admit, it might just be that we can't pick out the things we ought to be picking out. We don't know that. We don't know that much about that strain, so...
Is that going to be true of any desirable model organism that grows up quickly and makes up and reproduces a lot, that you're going to have a lot of genetic drift? Is there, you know, is that, isn't that kind of part of the territory with a model organism?
Yep, it's a good question. I think that's right. If you're thinking about the experiment that we're doing each time we turn over the generation.
You're selecting the ones that survive.
Yeah, and we've stopped doing this now, but in the past, you often select for example, the pairs that give you lots of embryos. Is that what you want, actually? I think we don't know if that's what you want. A lot of our protocols actually have come from the marine industry, where the maximum rate of protein mass production is what's being scored for. And so the kind of feeding regimes and things like that we've imported, but we haven't really stopped to think about, hang on, is that actually, wait a minute, what are we actually doing? I mean, any species that lays 500 embryos is gonna lose a few of them, right? So it's not that in the wild those 500 would have survived. Clearly there's gonna be a massive selection, but what are we selecting for in our culture? I think that's the important question. Yeah. So, my recommendation would be is work out what you're studying and select for uniformity of that process. And then... study a better organism. Finclip, and then finclip. So you have a record of the fish you've been working with. And then if something happens, you can go back and look. Okay, righto. So, zebrafish are diploid, and I wonder how many people here think that they're tetraploid. Has anyone heard that? Yeah. Okay. They're not tetraploid. They and other teleosts went through an additional round of genome duplication to what the tetrapods have, the cycopterygians, very deep in the lineage of the ray-finned fish, which means, for example, that zebrafish have 7 pox clusters, whereas humans and mice have 4, chicks have 4. They got 8 and then they lost one. But psychologically, they're obviously diploid, and they've been diploid for millions and millions of years. You could contrast that to Xenopus laevis, that is psychologically tetraploid, or actually even a salmon. Salmon are psychologically tetraploid. So there's another round of duplication that's happened in the salmonid lineage. So the duplication is happening all the time. Okay, so the reason why I think people say they're tetraploid is because in many cases there are these extra gene copies. And so people say, okay, this is hard to work with. You've got all these extra gene copies. Yes, that can certainly be true. In some cases, you see that there's one gene in the mouse, for example, that has 3 or 4 functions during development and gives you a lethal early on. In the zebrafish, those functions may have been split into separate genes, and now by mutating them separately, you can look at the function of the gene at different stages in a much cleaner way. So I don't think one can make any blanket statements. There's sometimes when it's a real pain in the bum, and there's other times where you say, wow, that's fantastic, but it's a real... just need to be aware. 25 chromosomes, no sex chromosomes, so I think it's still fair to say we don't really know how sex is determined in the zebrafish. There have been sex biasing regions found on some chromosomes, but they're not there in all of the different standard strains that actually look like they are being selected for in some of the standard strains. One practical problem is that there's no balance of chromosomes. Because of the way meiosis works, there's no balance of chromosomes in the zebrafish. So we have to keep all of our recessive lethals as heterozygous stocks and recover them each generation, which is one of the reasons why you need a lot of fish left. Yeah, and then the female. So, doing genetics in zebrafish, I think that this has started with early on chemical and radiation-induced mutagenesis, basically taking the methods that were used in bacteria and flies and testing how they work in the zebrafish. Insertional mutagenesis using retroviruses has also been successful. Looking at phenotypes in diploid and haploid backgrounds. No screen in zebrafish, I think, has been done to saturation, so I think we're still a long way from knowing the full complement of genes that might contribute to a particular phenotype. And we're still desperately short of alleles. So I think most of what we know in zebrafish about a particular trait comes from one, maybe most of two alleles. And if you think about work done in other genetic systems, that's really not enough. And I think probably you think about some very famous loci. The first couple of alleles that were spotted actually have, in some cases, really led on to sort of wild goose chases or only after accumulating. So I think this is changing, I hope, with the advent of CRISPR, where it's possible to not say something until you've got five different alleles and you say, that's time for you. Not sure why I wrote that. There are thousands of mutants known, and hundreds of them have now been cloned. So I think this is clearly not at the state of a more advanced genetic system, but it's clearly maturing, I think one could say. This is just a quick list of the examples of screens that have been done for morphology, for touch sensitivity, retinotectural projection, optic processing, hearing, heart physiology, temperature preference, digestion, blood coagulation, wound healing, regeneration, phototaxis, cancer. So I think the first screens started for early embryological morphology, and now the screens for behavior, for sleep, particularly the neurological things, I think are going to be telling us some really interesting stuff. I'll give you one snippet. Jason Rehell did a screen when he was in Alex Shear's lab, where he took a handful, or quite a large panel actually, of drugs that are allowed to be used on humans for psychiatric purposes. And he put them on fish, and he screened how it affected their sleep-wake cycle. So fish sleep after they've steered the pirate ship, and they go into their bed, and they have a very well-defined activity rhythm. And so what he found was that some of these drugs appear to influence the fish really strikingly in a very similar way to how they influence humans, either by suppressing activity or enhancing activity. So I think these are going to be very interesting ways to... there's a bunch of stuff you can ask of the fish. Okay. And now there are lots of live imaging screens where every fish in the screen is being filmed the whole time, and the details of their movement are being studied. So I think this is also, I mean, these are stuff that have been done in other organisms, but now I think, again, it's more a statement of the maturity of the field and the diversity of interests that now these things are being run very well, I think, in fish. So this slide was important a while ago when the genetics was much slower, but now with things like whole genome sequencing or whole exome sequencing, with CRISPRs, a lot of these things just aren't so important anymore, and I think that's also a sign of the way that technology is changing the way you go about using organisms. There is a high chromosomal syntony to humans, and that's to say that if you land on a particular place of a zebrafish chromosome with a particular gene, and you move locally along it, you're very likely to find the same local genes as if you'd landed on a human chromosome and hit that. Now, if you go far enough, you'll find a breakpoint. So globally, the sort of vertebrate ancestral genome is shuffled. It's massively shuffled, but the sort of the homology length is still quite long, even between fish and a human. So it's one of the ways of knowing if you've got the right gene, if you're interested in a human disorder, is by looking locally along those image crosses.
So how far do you go? What's the characteristic length of
that's good. Centennial? That's a good question.
Number of genes? 10? 100?
Number of genes?
Yeah.
Is Centennial blocks? I should know the mean and the dispersion, but I don't off the top of my head. I can look it up. I would say be in the order of 10 genes, not more. Yeah, it's super surprising. Yeah. I mean, different lineages shuffle their genomes at different rates. For example, mice shuffle. This is equivalent to a human mouse divergence.
You have inversions.
Yeah. So, okay. This is the community website, zfin.org. And so I think it's got a reasonable search engine and many databases are being linked there. So if you have a question, I personally routinely go here. There's a bunch of stuff that you can, people, alleles, protocols, papers. It's a good site. It's a good place to start.
I remember, you know, friends who have been trying to map mutants, yes, 5 years ago. They, yes, had a very hard time.
Yes.
Because of the assembly.
Good.
Has it improved over the last 5 years?
Yes. Yes. So this is a bit. This is another embarrassing secret of the zebrafish field, is that when the first sequence was done, it was done not of a single animal, but it was actually done from a pool of animals. And so, remember what I was saying, that we keep these lines deliberately outbred so that they are, you know, good to work with in the laboratory. So the first assembly was done on a population of these outbred animals, trying to get them all to line up, and it took years and years to get this sorted out. And in the end, some of the sort of great and the good in the field picked a single fish, I think it was from John Postlewaite's lab, a single fish, and said, right, we're going to sequence that one, and then we take all this other data and map it back to that. So now I think it's in much, much better shape. There's still quite a few AT-rich regions that are a bit troublesome, but I think overall it's now a mature sequence.
I mean, this has been a serious bottleneck to characterize all the mutants from the files that have been shown.
Yeah, no, I know. And I think that, you know, it's one of those things I could speculate, but I don't really know why it took us so long to correct it. How many years we spent just trying to reassemble what was the wrong sequences to start with. Yeah, no, it was a...
You live in London.
Where you live. Okay, embryology. So, let me just... So this is, of course, no one would be doing all this genetics if you couldn't see the embryo. And that's why it's so beautiful. So it's not completely transparent, obviously. It's highly transparent. Externally deposited, rapid development. So these are advantages. Rapid development, I'm not sure if that is... At first I thought, yes, that's great, rapid development. But now, sometimes, I think it goes too fast. And one of the ways this thing can go too fast is that if you're using fluorophores with particular half-lives or maturation times, your development can outstrip the rate at which your proteins can be useful to you. And so this now pushes us to find variant fluorophores which will be faster. The other thing is, now you could say, well, like any animal that grows outside its mum, might grow faster at hot temperatures and cooler at low temperatures. So, unfortunately, just slowing the thing down doesn't always fix that previous problem that I told you about, because everything slows down. But it's important when you're thinking about zebrafish embryology, and this is another sort of under-the-hood comment, zebrafish are massively temperature-sensitive. Their development, they can develop reasonably normally, I think quite normally, from about 20 degrees, probably up to about 35, at least from the strains we've used. Certainly between 20 and 30 degrees. At the end of that development, it's for us, it's impossible to tell which temperature that strain is growing at, unless they've got some mutations.
Can you give an example where whether your protein is not expressing fast enough for the process that you're interested in?
Yes, sure. For example, in somitogenesis, there is a molecular oscillator whose period is around about an order of tens of minutes. And so then we have a gene that's expressed, we now want to accumulate the fluorophore to get a good signal to noise, and then it needs to be degraded again on the same timescale. And so if you take a traditional GFP and express that in a zinc fish, that has a half-life, I guess, anywhere from about 6 hours. There's large error bars on that, I don't, from the measurements we've done. And the time it takes to mature, the time it takes enough of those molecules to mature so that you can pick it out, means that you get a long delay to when you can see the delay from the production to when you can see the signal. Does that make sense?
So when you say half-life is the time from...
So there's two half-lives I'm worried about. One is from when you make it to when you can see it fluorescing. And of course, for most fluorophores, that's characterized in vitro, so that's known. But it's known at a specific temperature, pH, redox, blah, blah, blah. And like any, I mean, this is not physics. In fish, you have to do the measurement in your lab because you don't know what that's going to be. Two timescales are important. That maturation time, and then the half-life once you've made it to get it to go away.
Can I just ask two temperature questions?
Yeah.
So one, you said you couldn't tell the difference at the end based on the temperature. Do they not vary their body size according to temperature like some other cold-blooded animals? So they don't get smaller at high temperature?
Not well. I don't know. Remember how I said I didn't know whether 35 was the upper limit? So we, at the moment, we've restricted the measurements that we've done and that are in the literature, I guess, to this region between 20 and 30, where I can tell you that doesn't happen. As you go more extreme, we don't yet know what happens there. So this is size of embryogenesis.
A size, well,
at what point are you measuring that?
Raised them at 20 or 30, yeah. They'd be much, much smaller.
But when are you doing the measurement, sorry?
In the adult.
Yeah, okay.
And also the pupae would be smaller.
Yeah, the pupae would be
sure is smaller.
Right.
I mean, they have a different critical weight at high temperature.
Right, yes.
Okay, that doesn't happen in zebrafish.
We can never weigh them, but we just know their length and their rate of extension. And we don't see them getting any longer as a result of the different temperatures. Of course, they get there faster.
Yeah.
But no. And in fact, you can map all of those morphometric measurements right on top of each other.
Really?
From 20 to 30.
Yeah. I mean, people have speculated that because oxygen consumption goes up with temperature, that there's been some evolutionary push, you know, to minimize body size at high temperatures. But not in fish. That's
Perhaps, so remember that I'm just talking about the first day and a half.
Okay.
And I don't know what would happen. So let's say the equivalent stage to a wandering larva or a pupa for a zebrafish, what is that once it started feeding?
Yeah, where most of the growth is happening.
Where the growth is happening. Then that's why I'm just saying we don't know. I would be super surprised if there wasn't something. We should look.
And then at high, so I guess if they come from, the Himalayas or something? Normally, in winter, they're going to be a lot colder than that. So would the adults survive a lower temperature in some kind of diapause that you could exploit for not, you know, having so much genetic drift if you kept them a long time?
That's a super question. So when you go to the field and you measure where zebrafish Danio rario can be found, they range in the wild from water temperatures about 18 degrees, the adults, to 40 degrees in rice paddies. So we have no idea at the moment of what the behavior of those species would be if we get them out, hold them at the same temperature, change their temperatures. So we've got a contact now to one of the research stations in India that have been doing these measurements, and I've now got enough Indian people in my lab that we can actually just go there and turn up. Although, I guess, given the world population, we're massively overrepresented for Australians and still underrepresented for Indians. And I think what would actually be really interesting is to sample much more broadly temperatures, other chemical compositions of where they're living, and now bring those into culture and see how they behave. Because it might be that the first strains that we brought into culture 30 years ago, 40 years ago, they were, I mean, I think they were just sort of, they were arbitrarily picked because of the ones in the fish shop down the road. And so, I mean, that's a bit of simplification because some other strains have come over since then. But there hasn't been, we haven't asked the question, which version of the zebrafish is best for what purpose? And what, yeah, I think it's fantastic. Also, when you look in the world, sorry, to come back to feeding, you see they don't eat anything like what we feed them. It's totally bizarre. So actually, I think we've also selected the zebrafish in culture to eat basically, okay, this is going to make you a bit sick, but chicken feathers, marine lipids, and marine proteins. And the last time I checked, zebrafish were a freshwater species. And there's a really big difference between lipid composition of terrestrial insects and marine fish and crustaceans. So, you know, I think we don't even know the basics. Gosh, I'm really, any of you guys get to review one of my grants, it's just going straight down. But I think this is huge. It's exciting when you work out that you don't know what you're doing because there's a chance to lose.
Just to say as an aside, the zebrafish in the laboratory is eating weird stuff and has been selected over the period of 20 years of zebrafish work, and it is very likely now something special that doesn't really correspond to what's swimming around in the natural environment.
Lords of fly.
Yeah, so as embryologists, though, we're interested in the circuits, you know, interested in how, you know, from a mechanistic standpoint, how does one go from DNA to mechanical, to visible transformations in cell morphology and cell fate? Does it matter that the one that we're working with in the phenomena we're working with in the lab has different lipid constitution, and maybe the cells have a different rigidity, and lots of properties could be different because they're involved in that peculiar Himalayan water stream? Why is that Himalayan water stream more interesting than what we have in the lab? If you're really interested purely in the mechanistic biophysical questions, why does it matter whether your organism is natural?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think these, and I would have to say, Eric, I'm not on some quest for the perfect zebrafish or the natural zebrafish, but I think there's two answers. One is, I just want one that will give me the reproducible phenomena that I'm interested in. And all of these factors cause that process to vary, even in the laboratory, when we're changing them or we're not doing them correctly. So that might be one reason to know about them. The other reason to know about them is that they will be a new kind of perturbation that we can do in the system. We've got the same genes, and now we can bring in these perturbations, and I would argue that that would deepen our understanding.
Can I just also say one thing about why we have to understand diet and temperature, maybe the normal diet, the normal temperature, but just how does it perturb the processes we're looking at in the lab? And we've just seen profound changes in, you know, development, or even like the efficiency of RNAi, for example, like this gene we're knocking down, ectisomalase. It's a conserved glycolytic regulator from humans to yeast. And if you feed them a good diet, it's a lot easier to knock down than if you feed them a poor diet. I mean, the results of your experiments can just change really dramatically depending on the diet. Even things you think shouldn't change so dramatically, nevertheless, they do. And the morphogen signaling pathways are presumably responding to metabolic states. So all and temperature that we use to just change gene expression, I mean, it's having such profound effects on the whole animal. I mean, I think it's essential we understand.
I agree that nutrition is important and interesting as a topic to understand, and how composition affects behaviors and so. I think that's important. I think that reproducibility, when one lab tries to reproduce the other lab's results and can't because they're eating a different insect, is worth knowing. But reproducing the natural in the laboratory, the natural environment in India or wherever these things is, can't be our goal. Our goal with respect to reproducibility should really be the thing that you were implying before, that some kind of standard condition.
We're blocking a... Did you have a question? Sorry.
I do have a question.
Yeah.
Thank you. I was wondering if the penetrance of mutant phenotypes are varied with temperature. See that their penetrance is greater at higher temperatures?
It depends on the phenotype. Some are more penetrant at lower. In fact, in segmentation, there's a whole set of cold-sensitive phenotypes. Yeah.
But how about null alleles? Do they show temperature sensitivity?
Yeah. Also. Yes, so, yes, nulls show as well. Yeah.
Can I also put, but one of the most temperature sensitive things out there appears to be heterochromatin, because even, so null alleles of, some of the chromatin modifying enzymes that were first identified in flies, they're in sort of a heterozygous situation, heterochromatin will go further in the cold than in the warm. It's just a property of heterochromatin. So, for sure.
Mm. Well, not only heterochromatin, cytoskeletal things, like anything depending on microtubule transport is very temperature sensitive. Yeah. Lower the temperature, the phenotype gets much worse.
Mm-hmm. But presumably you could imagine that developmental networks can, of course, and you probably want them to adapt to changes in the environment, but there's an environment language, which is the one that developmental biologists want to identify, which will be the same wherever you go. And I would argue that it is through the comparison of different kind of response that we can hope to identify this invariant language, as opposed to, just saying that one system is better than the one environment, or one polymorphism is better than another one. It is through the variation that you could identify the common language.
I think that's a really good point. We have a belief that there is a, that there are organizing principles, how genomes are expressed and how cells organize physically, and we know that they have to be adaptable because animals don't live in the wild and that's part of the astonishingness of these systems that we're interested in. Yeah, I think we need to embrace that, but we need to list it. Otherwise, the things we end up studying are different, but we don't know why they're different. And in those cases, this is quite a trivial point, right? We still got to do it. It seems like a lot of what science is continually reminding ourselves about these things. Now, of course, those are themselves amazing questions, right? I mean, how does an animal overwinter? How does an animal survive in a desiccated state for 10 years under a salt lake? And then it boots up the same developmental principles and grows a new... I mean, this is really mind-blowing stuff, right? But before I start winking with joy... See, it got too much for her. She thought, I can't take this. If we have to talk about estivation one more time...
Okay, so how long are you in this? So this was a digression.
I'm finished. I'm finished. After saying that much about zebrafish, I can tell you my research career is over. I'm keeping mind the time. I thought that I should not go over 10:30, but you tell me what.
No, well, listen, we're flexible, but somewhat flexible.
Yeah.
But what's in the next slide?
Right. This is part of my adaptation to things breaking. Embryology, the topic was embryology, and so this gives you an example of what, with a very simple wide field microscope, you can see the embryo doing. And so without really any sophistication, one can see the embryo making its head and its tail, putting its eyes in, extending its axis, making its somites. And so this
this, I think, is one of the reasons why it's fun to study zebrafish, because this is available through a dissection microscope. And to watch these things happening quickly, and it's really, I think it's really exciting. So you'll see probably a few more movies like that. And anyone who wants one, I'm happy to send it to you. They're really good for teaching, actually, these movies. Actually, just point out a couple of things. You can see the blood is forming here, and the heart's going to start pumping. And I don't know if you can catch the movement of the red blood cells sweeping across the... So show kids that heart beating under a dissection microscope. And it's just... They kids or PhD students. Or professors. Okay. Show truck and tell me. Right. Live observation. In early development, there actually aren't that many cells. Their cell types are reasonably well described, although we're picking up new cell types all the time. And what I'm going to show you... and so what that means is that this vertebrate will make a particular vertebrate structure, but will do it with about an order of magnitude less cells. And so that makes it much more easy to ask the question... I would argue it makes it easier to answer the question at a cellular granularity, which I'm interested in, and I think so. If easy to do time-lapse movies, Lynch tracing, bead implantation. So this is a classic embryological technique where you soak a bead in some substance you're interested in and embed it. And I think I've got a couple of movies here. This is, again, the somites forming. There's a notochord in the middle for the vertebrate aficionados. Somites, and can you see these cells on the side? These sort of great... This will become the blood and the pronephros. And so this is, again, just this is available through a simple microscope. Here's a FGF8 soaked bead. This is from Michael Brown's lab, showing that FGF is responsible for the expression of the midhindbrain boundary. Here's a mutant that loses FGF8. And now if you pop in a bead, with FGF8 into wild type, you can induce a second stripe of midhindbrain boundary. So very old school embryological technique you can use. Tissue grafting is the ability to cut a piece of one embryo and move it to another embryo. In chick, this can be done very, very easily because of the consistency of the tissue. In the zebrafish, it's very difficult. The reason is that the zebrafish has a thin epithelial, squamous epithelial cell layer of it. It starts off being called the enveloping layer, and then later on it's called the epidermal layer. But it makes it very difficult to do tissue grafting because it's so elastic. So if you come with a tungsten wire, try and chop the tail, chop through the tail, yes, I've done it. You see the tail sort of sitting a little bit front, pull back your needle, and then you go back to the embryo and you go, what happened? Actually, the skin deformed down with your needle, went right through the embryo. You brought the needle back, the skin just popped back into place and holds the tail on. So getting rid of that skin is the key to doing any tissue grafting. And there's a couple of different ways to do that. They're fiddly, and that's part of the skill of doing it. I'll show you a picture of what Alex Picker can do with a little blob of mineral oil to blister the skin locally and then transplant a piece of tissue. On the other hand, that skin makes a beautiful bandage after you've done the placement. It seals super quickly back over the wound. So people study wound healing in that tissue. Because it's transparent, you can ablate cells with UV laser. You can explant pieces of the embryo out to grow them in vitro. But I think that this is still, again, like the chick, we're not mature. We don't yet really understand how to do that. And the examples in the literature of where it's actually helped us are few and far between. Similarly, primary cell culture. We really don't understand how to do that properly. I'm going to talk a bit about that later in the coming weeks. But that's, I think, where we really need to understand stuff. Very few tissue culture ones. I think in part that's because people say, well, look, you can see the cells in the embryo. Don't take the cells out. Leave them there. That's what you're interested in. But I think you need as many tools to throw at the problem as you possibly can. So I think that's a real area where we can grow. Tissue transplantation. So here's an example where Alex Picker had a donor animal stained in one dye, had a so that should be in red actually, and he cut out one of the eyes at about 18 somite stage, and he transplanted it onto the other host. And so now you can look at the contribution of the genotype of the host and donor to, for example, how the retinal axons grow out and innervate the tectum. So this sort of mosaic animals is a really good, that's a real strength, making mosaic animals and then being able to image the resulting phenotypes. Is another way to do the transplantation. You label a donor, a mutant donor and a wild type donor with two different colours. You grow them up till they've got about 1,000 cells. You pull out some of the cells that are not yet determined, and you transplant them into a third unlabeled host animal into the location that will give rise to the tissue that you're interested in. So because fate maps are quite well known for this early stage of zebrafish. And those were done by Chuck Kimmel's group in the 80s. 80s and 90s. Okay, so now you can look at the fate of these two cells with two different genotypes in the embryo as they grow up. And I've got examples of those, but in the interest of time, I'll just skip over them. You can easily pick out the two different colour cells and work out what cell will become what. Okay. Molecular toolbox. So when we want to see where a gene is expressed, we can use a riboprobe, use antibodies. If you're modifying a zebrafish embryo, almost certainly you have to inject it at some point. And that's the way you get stuck into a zebrafish embryo. And you usually do it very early. Preferably if it has a single cell, so the zygote. You inject mRNA, DNA, morpholino, so antisensory agents. Transgenesis works well in zebrafish. There are promoter GFP fusions to look at gene expression. Heat shock constructs, which was borrowed from the flies. Binary systems, also borrowed from the flies. TET systems. And transposons and retroviruses to bring in a gene that can be spliced and expressed. So all of these systems function in zebrafish, but I would say again, they're not as mature as they are, for example, in the flies. We still have, let's say, tens of lines that might address the question, where it seems like there's maybe 100 lines. One feels a bit jealous. Maybe quickly a word on morpholinos. I don't know how many of you have heard recently the sort of debate about whether morpholinos ought to be used in zebrafish. Has this got through to? So morpholinos are a synthetic nucleic acid that doesn't have a normal sugar linkage, and so it can't be cleaved by endonucleases that are present in the cell, and so it's incredibly durable. So you inject it in early on, it is quite small molecular weight, so it diffuses through the whole early embryo, then all the cells inherit it. After early cleavage, when the cells are intact, you can actually then transplant that cell and put it somewhere else, and it now keeps the knockdown of that gene. So these work by inhibiting splicing, if they bind to the gene, or they can inhibit translation if they bind to the mRNA. And one of the big problems with any antisense agent, or really any reagent, right, is that how do you know what it's going to do? And I think when they were first brought in, there was such a flood of excitement and enthusiasm that people just raced out and they injected everything, and and suddenly there were millions of new phenotypes, and a lot of them were published without some basic controls, frankly. And it's it now has quite a legacy in the literature that there is a period of zebrafish research where you have to look very carefully. You have to really ask yourself whether all of the controls are there. One of the main problems is that if you inject too much of a morpholino, it's going to make your animal get sick and grow slowly. And that will deform the shape of the organs, it will do a whole bunch of stuff. And so if you focus just on this eye, you don't look at the rest of the animal, you've got a funny eye, oh, look, my gene X affects the eye. There's been a really big fight internally in the zebrafish community recently, because a couple of people said, we can't replicate a single morpholino experiment, and we're going to publish it. And then another group of people said, well, here we've got a bunch of single allele mutations in genes, which you're saying should be the gold standard, and I'm going to show you that they've all got different phenotypes, none of which map back to other alleles of the same gene. or a whole bunch of other, you know, like null deletions and things like that. So I would say that be careful if you hear zebrafish people getting very, very hot-blooded about morpholinos. And I would say that they have the same, they carry the same risks as using a new antibody. You don't just get a new anti-sera, put it on the animal and expect. You have to do all of the controls. You have to ask yourself all the time, how can I be being tricked? So I'm in favour of morpholinos. I would put my hand up for morpholinos. I'm also in favour of controls. All right. RNAi doesn't appear to work in zebrafish. Nobody really knows why. I'm not saying it won't work. I'm just saying that at the moment we don't understand, because it's got all the genes there that we think should do it. It's got Hagenwort, Dicer and stuff. We just don't know experimentally how to trigger that to get it to work. So transgenic zebrafish, I think, and this will probably be, I think, close to the last thing I want to say, is I think this is one of the, I guess a personal bias, one of the joys of working with zebrafish, because they're transparent, is being able to label cells, structures, subcellular structures in the animal. Here I'm showing a couple of examples of labeling the floor plate of the central nervous system in the top, and here labeling all of the vasculature. And so here, have incredible access in the early embryo to really fine scale structures of the vasculature growing and anastomosing. And, so this library is still being built. Here's, for example, from our own work, the tail of a zebrafish now marking all the nuclei with histone 2-AGFP. So this is a way to track all the positions of the nuclei, at least, and infer what the cells are doing. And you can see divisions there. And then this is another example from our research where we've got two tagged trans genes, and I don't want to go into this in any detail. I'll hope to talk about it later, but the thing I want to point out to you is that by combining the transgenes with the bright field microscopy, you can make really accurate measurements of where the genes are expressed and how they relate to the morphology. So this is really fun. This is really fun stuff to do with zebrafish. It's very difficult to do this on a mouse embryo, for example. Not impossible, right? But just very difficult. Okay. And finally, and this I hope will, this is again the tail, and now I've got two, the transgene's gone. Okay, so it is utrophin GFP, this labeling the actin cortex and the nuclei being labeled by a histone GFP. And so I think this is a good example of the accessibility of the tissue in the zebrafish to microscopy, and being able to pick out both the tissue level context and cellular scale interactions. Now, in this magnification, we're not going to be able to say too much about subcellular localization, but I think change objectives in my view. Spin microscopy, for example, is an extraordinarily useful zebrafish. Here I wanted to say, it gives a good example of the granularity of tissue formation in the zebrafish, because you can see exactly how many cells need to go, for example, into one segment, and you can see, you have a reasonable hope of following all of their behaviour through that process. And then, future. CRISPR-Cas9 works in zebrafish. Talons and zebrafish work in zebrafish. I expect that everything we can do with CRISPR-Cas9 in other systems will work in zebrafish. We're lagging slightly behind at the moment. I don't know of any reliable reports of being able to do targeted gene replacement in zebrafish. There's a few groups have said, look, we've knocked a GFP into this locus. We've done it ourselves. I'm just not sure that it's yet at the efficiency where it's gonna rock and roll, but I hopefully that's very, very coming very soon. So I used to think we needed ES cells, but now, of course, we don't. Although understanding how early cells in zebrafish work in culture, I think that's a very important line of research. Need a much better library of driver responder lines. So this is just, it's like playing piano in the fly sometimes, when you see all the different things you can bring in and out. We're way, way, way under-resourced in the zebrafish. I think that's going to be really good. Right, mutants. Chemical screening. I think still underutilized. The good thing about chemical prints, we talk a lot about it in terms of drug discovery, but I think that for developmental biologists, chemical screening is an incredible treasure chest. In zebrafish, all you have to do, they grow up in water, you just drop the compound into the water. The screening couldn't be easier. And having, of course, there are all the normal questions about what is this molecule touching and how is it affecting. But even a small handful of these probes, you can change concentration and timing, and they are really wonderful, can be very wonderful additional tools in your toolbox. One thing that we're really lacking is antibodies. For the zebrafish community, just didn't make any antibodies. And we can talk about that over a cup of coffee or something, but the fact remains we have very, very few antibodies that we culturally use in the zebrafish community, and people don't ask for an antibody and say, you can't publish this until you show me the... It's kind of weird, I don't know why. So I think that's something we really need to focus on in the future. Okay, I think that's it. Oh, no, wait, one last second. MS2 stem loop to tag individual mRNAs, that appears to be working now in zebrafish. I think that's a really good tool to bring in to be able to watch things in real time. And I think what I think we still haven't remotely started to harvest the potential is optogenetics. Because an animal that transparent, there's no cell in the early embryo that you can't reach with a laser. And so there's no cell you can't manipulate by turning a construct on or off. And I think we're still we haven't really got into this and used it as well as we could. And I think that's really where I think that will give us a whole new layer of access and precision intervention. Okay, thanks very much. That's it. Thanks for coming. There's been some claims that it can be done, but I've got those data sets and I believe the claims are false because I've tried to, using those data sets, actually follow through the cells, and you get all sorts of crazy stuff going on, like cell traps fusing together again, and the average distance between nuclei being closer than the diameter of the nucleus, and there's all sorts of... But I think that particularly in the early embryo, I would say up to about 10 hours of development, the cells are big. They're still big because they're still undergoing reductive cleavage where they're getting smaller as they divide. And the nuclei are well separated. And I think maps made up to that stage are pretty reliable. But I think it's going from that stage, from about the first half a day to then the next 24 hours, that's still really difficult. There's some people, I mean, people are doing some amazing work there. Don't get me wrong, progress is really being made. But there's a question of like, okay, we can do in toto reconstruction. And I have to ask, why do you want to do in toto reconstruction? I mean, it's incredibly technically impressive, no doubt. But does your question actually require you to know where every single cell is gone? If it doesn't, then don't measure all the cells that, measure the ones you need to, or know how many you need to measure in order to answer the question. So I think we're still not quite there. I think spin microscopy is going to help enormously. It's already helping. Something like structure spin has a limit to how far it can see into the tissue, and because the zebrafish gets reasonably big, pretty soon, I'm not sure whether that's going to give us a... So I'm talking about resolution now to be able to separate touching objects. So that's a big problem, separating touching objects. In traditional microscopy, where you've got the point spread function in one orientation, which is poor, then touching objects in that direction is a major problem for segmentation, and that kicks on to tracking. So that's what has to be solved. So in isotropic imaging, we've got a long way to do.
Did you say something about freezing stuff?
Yeah.
Is it basically by person? I was envious of the technologies that would allow you to freeze samples and then we store them. And so to put what is possible in fish, and then do people really make, do fish labs really make use of the possibility of freezing down sperm or embryos or whatever, what's possible? And then,
Are we doing it properly? Yeah, it's a really good question. So, it's possible to freeze every part of the fish. you can freeze and thaw sperm and do in vitro fertilization. And so, that protocol is fiddly. And there's only a few labs I know where they do it reliably, but it's learnable. Go to the lab, learn it, do it. So, because of that, it's not yet in our traditions, and because of this generation time of, let's say, 4 months till I can use it, people are very loath to retire a line, go back to the frozen stock, and so we haven't made it a habit yet. We have to, because we can now generate with CRISPR-Cas9, we can generate far more lines than we can possibly maintain. We must use the freezers.
What you do is you freeze. It's only sperm.
Only sperm.
And so what that means is that you can't reliably get around the problem of heterogeneity or cell lines or fish lines evolving over time, because you can't freeze fish line. You have frozen sperm, but you still have to mate it out to some other line in your laboratory.
Yeah.
So you can't reproduce.
You can't actually solve that problem. No, you can halve it. Yeah.
So is that really a limitation for a fish? Because I mean, it's just such a powerful tool, isolating fish, and you would think. Yeah. And I don't understand why there are not more people that are starting to.
And not all the systems are working. On paper, things work, and then you put them into flies, even.
But I think the neuroscientists are doing it. Marty Halpern was here and gave a seminar. And in the larvae, I think particularly embed them in agarose, and so you immobilize them, and that, I mean, essential.
But the question is more how practical it is to do. I mean, it doesn't take like 3 years to do a pH and a lot of tinkering, or it's like something that you can do.
But here's the thing, so if you take the channel rhodopsins, which are robust and working fish, then you are good to go as long as your receptor couples into something you're interested in, like depolarizing. So the neuroscientists, many of them are using it, and they're using it, I think you're right, they're using it very, very successfully. And you want to bring that into a developmental event, you need some way of hooking the light-induced change to the event you're interested in, and now it gets a bit more tricky, and this is where the tinkering.
Has anyone tried the photoactive rat? Because we've used the mammalian one in a fly, and it works fine, so you should be able to use it.
So that's a good example of the one that works.
Yeah,
for
Roe
and
yes.
Supposed
yeah,
to
those
do
don't work.
Yeah.
Well, no, CDC 42 works, but Roe doesn't.
But Roe, I mean, it's more. You have to use other
techniques. So, Harald Stanjevac from IST has been working on blue inducible dimerization proteins, and I don't know if you saw, but Carl Phillips just published a paper using those, and I think that's going to be one way that if you can think of a way to build dimerization into that could be. Becomes routine. I think it's fiddly, and it's one of those cases where if you have someone who doesn't like the molecular biology and the microscopy, then it can be frustrating. So I mean, we just got to throw our shoulders to the wheel. Okay. Thanks very much. Excellent question. Thank you very much.